century statue, which is the one you see in front of you, in the Paris Medical Faculty. An almost identical, though polychrome one, was on display last year at the exhibition of French 19th century sculpture held in Paris, and you have a photocopy of that on your sheet. It was by Louis-Ernest Barrias and made in 1899. Once seen, it appears almost banal in its personification of nature as a young woman, only her breasts showing, and its choice of the very moment of unveiling as its subject matter. It implies that science is a masculine viewer who is anticipating full knowledge of nature, which is represented as the naked female body. This statue is, I think, easy to understand, despite the fact that it brings together a number of distinct abstract ideas, presumably because such ideas are now quite widely discussed. But if we look at veiling and gender more generally, however, the issues become altogether more complex. This paper focuses on the veiling and unveiling of women's bodies as vehicles for thinking about knowledge, especially of a scientific or medical kind. We can agree that veiling is an idea peculiarly associated with women. With both brides and nuns, veils seem to be associated with female chastity and modesty on the one hand, and with their submission to authority on the other. And perhaps this is also true of another occasion on which women veil themselves, that is, while mourning. In these cases, the head, and particularly the face, is the crucial area. Veils are also associated with the explicitly sexual modesty of women, as in the wispy little bits of material strategically placed in much Renaissance painting. As Leo Steinberg has put it, quote, "These veils charming a woman's flanks were meant to delight." Unveiling also has specifically female connotations, not just because of the eroticism of the female body, but because of the female personification of both nature and truth, with in each case a positive value given to nakedness. And I just show, could we have on the other side, please, two examples of truth, that is, as it were, the unveiling of truth, both by Bernini, and another, I think, altogether more entertaining version, which is, and on the other side, please, two versions of Hogarth's, on this side a drawing, on this side a print, little piece which is called Boys Peeping at Nature. Now, obviously, this is particularly interesting because they're not peeping at nature, they're peeping at a statue, and therefore, presumably, Hogarth is putting into play a whole set of questions about these ideas, and I'm not going to pursue that in any detail. I just show those as examples of the kind of thing that you find. But at the same time as we have examples like this where presumably at some level, and certainly in the Bernini examples, this positive value is given to nakedness, what is actually unveiled, I think, can have an altogether more ambiguous status. Now, of course, there are many places where these different associations of women and veiling are mixed together. And it's this fact, I think, which makes the complex nexus of femininity and veils especially interesting. Veils offer a rich metaphorical field. Some uses are openly pejorative. In the words of the Oxford English Dictionary, to draw a veil over means to hide or conceal, to refrain from discussing or dealing with, to hush up or keep from public knowledge. While other meanings simply stress the physical concealment, the verb to veil also, according to the Oxford English Dictionary again, denotes, quote, to conceal some immaterial thing from apprehension, knowledge, or perception, to deal with so as to hide or obscure, to hide the real nature or meaning of something. We learn two things from this. First, that veiling has to do with knowledge and truth. And secondly, quite obviously, it implies a link between such knowledge and the capacity for unimpeded vision. We find these points neatly exemplified in visual form in a painting by Charles Wilson Peale, the American artist, born in 1741, died in 1827, entitled The Artist and His Museum of 1822. Here, Peel unveils his museum for the viewer to see both the orderly arrangement of natural objects and the pictures of exemplary persons painted by himself. He saw such portraits as, and I quote from a historian who's written about him, representing man as, and this is his phrase, the head of the Linnaean order, of, and then of nature. His subjects were those who had distinguished themselves in the revolution. Just as interesting is the way in which this museum project changed his artistic procedures. And I quote from this historian again. To preserve his human specimens and portraits, Peel felt he had to achieve as close a likeness as possible. Therefore, he began to render even the smallest details of his sitter's features with great fidelity. He also devised a special format for the museum portraits, which set off the likeness and minimized distracting details. In a number of senses, then, Peel unveiled nature and human nature to allow the spectator's unimpeded vision, and presented himself, since the picture is also a self-portrait, as the principal agent of these multiple revelations. There are then two sides to the question of veiling and unveiling. On the one hand, we can attend to the veil and that which it either conceals or reveals, that is, woman, nature, truth. While on the other, we are drawn to consider the act of looking itself. In both cases, the metaphorical associations are very rich and diverse, moving from religion, that is, nuns' ideas of revelation, which is obviously about removing the veil, the cover of a chalice is called a veil, to mystery of a non-religious kind, and deceit. But in both cases, the implications for medical and scientific knowledge are clear. And this is because the process of looking goes to the heart of our epistemology. From classical times, science and medicine have explicitly concerned themselves with the correct interpretation of visual signs, and skill in those fields was preeminently seen as a form of visual acuteness. Western scientific traditions have customarily placed looking at center stage, although to be sure they have done so in historically specific ways. But this point alone would not establish the significance of veiling as a metaphor. We also know, however, that the ancient Greeks and Romans were interested in physiognomy, a subject which was based on the premise that everything we want to know is not on the surface of objects, but has to be elicited by decoding visual signs. This gave rise to a tradition which dominated scientific thinking for centuries, presented itself as an agent of the unveiling of the true inner nature of things. Sorry, I'm just going to move down to another bit of the, and which allowed such statements as the following to be made, and I quote, "Between us and the invisible world, there is a gross cloud and veil of flesh which interposes." And again, "I am sure within this veil of flesh there dwells a soul." Now clearly these statements reveal the significance of unveiling for religious language too. But nonetheless, perhaps, physiognomy offers one tiny clue as to why knowledge might be associated both with vision and with the impediments to that vision. What then, we must ask, is it that the... why then, we must ask, is it the female that is to be veiled or unveiled? Un- or covering women's bodies has two implications that may be pertinent here. First, it implies shame and modesty, originally presumably that of Eve, but by the 18th century, women's modesty no longer carried an overtly human significance, but is seen rather as a guarantee that women will veil their voluptuousness in the service of social and possibly psychic stability. I think this is a not unreasonable interpretation of Rousseau's concern with modesty, and we find it taken up in fictional form by Rousseau's follower, Bernardin de Saint-Pierre. The second implication is that modesty implies, that the unveiling of women implies secrecy. That is, women's bodies cannot be treated as fully public. Something dangerous might happen, secrets let out, if they were open to view. And I just would draw your attention to the other little picture on your handout, which is almost exactly contemporaneous with the ones I started with, and is simply called The Secret. And it obviously, again, tries to explore in visual forms the question of secrecy, women's bodies, and unveiling, in fact, at many different levels, because it also, of course, has the box, which is often associated with the secrecy of women. Yet by presenting something as inaccessible and dangerous, there is an invitation to know and to possess. And what is striking here is that possession, either of women or of the knowledge they stand for, is ultimately elusive. In what sense can one own an idea or another's body? Now, here it may be helpful to remember that our inability to neatly separate science and magic until scientists themselves began self-consciously to affect a schism, so that knowledge essentially was arcane, even dangerous, but is certainly mysterious, reached through many different forms of revelation, that is, that one could only actually gain knowledge quite consciously for many centuries through some notion of something which was dabbling with the dangerous. And I think it's for this reason that the Enlightenment became a significant turning point, precisely because people strove to redefine proper knowledge as deriving from the open study of what could be viewed, I mean, hence obviously the imagery of the Enlightenment itself, without damaging the basic sense, however, that visual signs in nature required interpretation. Science and medicine, as they claimed special truth status for themselves, were drawn both to personifications of nature as woman and to the image of unveiling in order to represent their privileged relationship to truth and to nature. They could thereby become the domain strong enough to grapple with the complex forces nakedness embodied. Now, one significant feature of veils is that unlike most other type of material or clothes, they reveal and conceal at the same time. The whole point about veils is that they are sufficiently translucent to hint at what lies beneath them, and hence they invite the viewer to fantasize about, quote, the real thing, in anticipation of seeing it. Hence, veils imply a form of truth beneath a layer, and I will come back later on to this question of layers, which only certain people, possibly only men, may reveal. But then we must still ask, what does lie beneath this veil? In the case of Oriental women who are veiled in public, it is presumably their full femininity, their private personhood, that lies behind the veil. In his 1820 article on physiognomie in the Dictionnaire des Sciences Médicales, the early 19th century medical practitioner Viret explicitly presented his subject as one which, quote, unveiled the nature of individual character, before referring to the veiling of Eastern women, which he used to assert that unless people use their faces in speech, that is, in public intercourse, they don't have a physiognomy to interpret. For Viret, therefore, nothing lies behind that particular veil, and the veil, far from concealing something enticing, has become a barrier to its development. But more conventional in its meaning is the dance of the seven veils, where the mystery of feminine sexuality emerges gradually into view. And in the personifications of nature and truth which are unveiled, it is no less than reality itself which is finally exposed. Here, the secrets of nature and the universe are in an unspecified way identified with the secrets of women's bodies. And I want to say something here, just very briefly, about the sort of gender complexity of that identification of secrecy with women. Because it does seem to me interesting that the mythical origins of this, that is in the story of Pandora, is in fact linked with the story of Prometheus. Pandora comes into the world because of what Prometheus has done. And that it struck me that there's in fact a very interesting distinction, therefore, that's being made in that story between the way in which men are involved in the giving away of secrets and the way in women are involved in the giving away of secrets. Because both are involved in deception, hence presumably the linkage, which in fact comes quite late on in the mythological history of the story. Both are involved in deception, and therefore presumably the story partly sort of sets one deception against another. But in Prometheus's case, he deceives on behalf of the human race, and he suffers as a result of this in order to defend what is perceived in the story as the rights of mankind against the gods. Pandora, on the other hand, does not herself suffer, but makes others suffer. Actually, Robert Graves says she is presented, therefore, as the typical woman. And the crucial thing about that is that she is able to effect this this deception, not in the way that Prometheus does, which is by sort of going behind people's backs, but because she looks so beautiful that it's impossible for the men who encounter her, as it were, to really come to terms with the fact that she may be dangerous to them, even though they have some unarticulated sense of this. So it seems to me that actually there's a kind of double juxtaposition in the story of Prometheus and Pandora. I mean, not only that the nature of their suffering in relation to secrecy is quite different, but the occasion for Pandora's deception is precisely about interpreting the visual clues correctly. Because the point is that in order to make mankind suffer, Pandora is made so beautiful, she is more beautiful than any other woman could ever be, one could imagine to be. So there's actually a double sense in which that story gives rise to a lot of the themes that I'm talking about today. But I want to stress, nonetheless, that I think this question of how it is possible to possess women and knowledge, how it is possible to get hold of those secrets, is something which can never, almost by definition, be adequately resolved. I mean, there's no point at which one can say, I think, yes, one has it. And that actually, I think, is an interesting point of difference with what even Fox Keller was talking about just now, because by presenting the DNA thing as the riddle, and the discovery as the solution to the riddle, people felt that they had actually reached it. But the story, I think, here is always that somehow one never does quite reach it. There's always that sense of dissatisfaction, never quite being able to get hold of things. So that although veiling and unveiling have a wide range of associations which are not necessarily gendered, that is, I mean, the Prometheus thing, I think, does suggest that it doesn't have to be that way, there nonetheless seems to be a sense in which these ideas are intimately intertwined with our conception of femininity. And at the risk of being a little facetious, I want to exemplify this point by using the contemporary British artist Beryl Cook, whose work some of you may know, who I think has, can we have the one on the other side, in her own modern idiom, tried to get us to think about exactly this question. Now, Beryl Cook's art seems to me to be a wonderful embodiment of the points that I've just been making, and infinitely more entertaining. The male stripper is comic, good-humoured. The picture conveys a sense of fun and comfort. These same ladies who are watching the man take his clothes off go to Women's Institute meetings and excursions to the seaside. I mean, I think that's what we're supposed to think when we look at the picture. The artist herself describes the women as, quote, handsome women dressed in their finery. And I think it's interesting, their dignity doesn't seem to be at all threatened by this rather extraordinary thing that they're involved in. So that essentially what the picture tells us is that unveiling men is comic and unthreatening. I mean, I don't think, well, I love that picture. I think it's marvelous. And presumably we can find it so funny because there's nothing dangerous or worrying about it. And I take the reason for this to be because men's bodies are not, for us at any rate, the carriers either of creative or destructive forces. I mean, at the moment at which he takes his jock strap off, I don't think we imagine something awful has been let loose. although maybe one might think otherwise. Now, the lady on the top of the car is, I think, quite a different matter, because I think we could see her as a process of, as having been unveiled. She's unveiled, I think, in a way the man is not and cannot be, and she exists there as a kind of monument. Now, I suppose you could see this as painting as a send-up, but I don't think it's a feminist critique of the notion of women as possessions. She is, in fact, gracing a car, that is, an unashamedly masculine possession by virtue of her presence on it. New models of cars, like statues, plaques, and women, are unveiled. The painter's caption, interestingly, reveals her desire to own a Rolls-Royce. so that unveiling women is accepted and acceptable since it fulfills masculine desire allied with fantasies of ownership and display. And it is sought not just as a prelude to possession, but because it is potentially risky. I mean, presumably it wouldn't be any fun unless there was an element of danger in it. Now, in the case of women and motor cars, the desire for possession can be perfectly explicit, and it's obviously encouraged in our society through advertising, among other things, which repeatedly portrays sexual and material possession together. We therefore have a number of quite concrete ways of thinking about having, and a ready source of images, which, with various degrees of sophistication, draw on deep assumptions about femininity, knowledge, and looking. But when we turn to science and medicine in a historical setting, matters are much less straightforward, both because we're dealing with a greater degree of abstraction and with sociocultural settings which neither contained many material embodiments of these ideas nor the technology to reproduce them, especially in visual form. And I simply want to stress here that it's actually not unimportant, I think, that a lot of the periods that I'm interested in, there is simply not the ready means of producing, say, anatomical pictures easily, cheaply, or accessibly. So that books about these subjects in the 18th century, however much they might develop, for example, very elaborate verbal metaphors, do not provide people with actual visual images to go along with them. And I think that does produce a rather different sort of deployment, if you like, than a society like ours, where we have a sort of surfeit of models constantly paraded before us. And often those models are quite explicitly connected, say, with well-known pieces of art, if you look at advertising, for instance. For many centuries, this was not the case. And I think we should not disdain looking at those aspects of material culture, which actually might explain why it is that people think about these things in particular sorts of ways. And I stress this in order to say, then, that I think before you have the mass production of books, the vehicles that people use for exploring these questions are necessarily very different than they are in say, post-mid-19th century culture. So I think if we're interested in looking more, in more detail, at this question of unveiling women, science, medicine, knowledge, and so on, we have to search for cases where these things will, as it were, be brought together in a concentrated form in historical materials. Now, one example where they are is frontispieces of scientific and medical treatises, which contain many examples of the personification of knowledge or of particular sciences as women, as well as the theme of unveiling knowledge. But here I'm going to talk about a rather different case, which brings together these elements that I have discussed so far in a quite specific way. That is, its representation of dissection using the female corpse. And I want to stress that I think, although a lot of the themes I've been talking about so far I've presented in a rather ahistorical way, here is a very historically specific theme. Veiling, I think, is interesting because it has both this mythical dimension, but also it can at one and the same time become very deeply rooted in a particular sort of sociocultural setting. Now, in the case of representations of dissection using a female corpse, there is a real female body to be possessed, an actual sort of material thing which can be made to yield up secrets and generate knowledge. Now, it's my belief that in most early depictions of dissections, the corpse is generally male or unsexed, although there are obviously exceptions to this, of which Vesalius is one. But the obsession with a female corpse seems to me to be a late 18th and a 19th century phenomenon. Now, in a sense, this is not surprising. The morbid fascination of death, characteristic of what I'll call, if you'll forgive me, Romanticism, has been brilliantly described by Philip Ariès in The Hour of Our Death. In a chapter on The Age of the Beautiful Death, he uses writings by members of the La Véronèse family to illustrate a quite historically specific preoccupation with what he calls the death of the other, that is, the other as opposed to the self. In ways that we may find insufficiently historically rooted, but which are nonetheless suggestive, he associates this death of the other with privacy, the nuclear family, and what he calls absolute affectivity. Most pertinent, however, is his comment that death had become moving and beautiful like nature. In other words, both death and nature have become erotically charged. The language of death he describes there, although verbal, had clear visual correlates. I think that's your side. No. Thank you. And this, I think, is one of them. This is a picture produced in 1864-6. It's a print from a painting which is in the Frankfurt Historical Museum, and it shows a named professor undertaking a dissection. Now, the sense of inquiring into nature is conveyed by composition, by lighting, by a group of men peering at a female corpse. But it is considerably heightened by the fact that the dissection is actually in progress, as we can see from the fact that a piece of skin is being lifted up. In fact, it looks almost like a piece of fine material in itself. This leads us to see that dissection is itself a process of unveiling, of removing layers, not of clothes, but of organic tissues. Now, the term tissue is, of course, significant, since it was a key concept in pathological anatomy, for instance, as in Bichat, which endowed the act of dissection with a special status in 19th century medicine as its symbolic core, the place no less where signs of pathology were revealed to the medical gaze. Tissues, then, are both thin layers, that is, they are veils, but they are also the basic components of living matter. Indeed, veil itself has a biological meaning, a membrane, membranous appendage or part, serving as a cover or screen, a velum. And these usages begin, interestingly, in 1760 for botany, 1829 for anatomy, and 1810 for zoology. Now, once again, we can ask the question, what lies beneath the veil or the tissues? And I want to move slightly and use a different sort of example. And can we have the one on the other side, please, in order to illustrate one possible sorry, can we have the one on that side? In order to illustrate one possible answer to what could lie beneath. Because obviously the first picture I showed you doesn't tell us that. Now these, let me just explain very quickly what they are. These are wax anatomical models made mostly in Florence in the 18th century. And, I mean, one could talk for a long time about them, but one of the things that's very interesting about them is that they are made with removable flaps or layers. So when you look at the models, you can take the layers off, just like you could, as it were, in dissection. And I show these because I think they suggest a quite interesting suggestion, which I'll attempt to use this piece of technology. Right. Which is that there is the little tiny fetus. So you can take off all the kind of layers and layers and layers, and in the end, you get through into the little tiny child in the womb. And can we have the other one on the other side, please? This is simply another example of the same sort of thing. Now let's return to the Hasselhorst picture. It is significant in two respects. It gave visual expression to a more general curiosity about women, their bodies, death, post-mortems. And it also initiated a whole visual tradition. And I want to give brief examples of both of these. My first example is the French historian Jules Michelet, who, as many of you may know, was keen on women's bodies, I think is the way of putting it. He was the person who recorded very faithfully all the details of his second wife's menstrual cycle. But all his other enthusiasm for women's bodies was that he particularly enjoyed going to dissections. I don't say that to suggest that he was a kind of, there was something nasty about this, because in fact when he writes about it, it's really quite touching and lyrical. If you look, for example, in his book called La Femme, published in 1859, very close in date to the Hasselhorst picture, he describes in great detail how he goes to this dissection and he sees the body of a young woman who has drowned, I think it is, and how he watches, you know, her body being revealed by the anatomist. Now, obviously, again, one could talk at great length about what this is about in Michelet, but because time is short, I just want to point out that what Michelet is able to do there when he talks about women in that context is he's able to put together a number of different elements. First of all, he has the category of woman. Secondly, he treats woman as other. Thirdly, he identifies woman with nature. Fourthly, he then puts all of those into play by talking about women as dead, and therefore women as revealing in their death their social pathology. And when he talks about it that way, he is inviting us to identify with the experience that the woman had had before her death, which gave rise to the particular physical phenomena which we see laid out before us. In other words, what Michelet did was to invite us to see the condition of women in relation to their symbolic status, but also their pathological and their social status, visually reenacted in the dissecting room. In other words, I think what Michelet is writing about is what underpins the picture that I just showed you. Now let me move to the second set, that is the way in which that picture initiated a visual tradition. The American artist and anatomist John Wilkes Brodnax, born in 1864, died in 1926, is an example of someone who took up Hasselhorst's image, although how consciously he did this we don't know. Many elements from the earlier picture are reproduced here. Oh, sorry, I did put it in the wrong direction. And can we have the one on the other side, please? The recumbent woman, the signs of death, the male onlooker. Yet there are also significant differences. The Hasselhorst picture is a picture of an anatomist and his colleagues dissecting a woman. Brodnax's pictures are self-portraits, and we may remember Peel again here. And sometimes, as in the one on your right, he appears twice in one picture. And by putting himself in the picture, of course, what he's done is he's made the theme of the fantasy of dissection an explicit part of the depiction of dissection. It is both as an anatomist, an artist, and a subject, that is, as a multiple participant, that Brodnax creates these images. In both cases, he appears contemplative and almost melancholy. One is entitled Only a Dream, that's the one on the far side. Yet it remains unclear what is dreamlike. The chance to dissect a beautiful woman. In Only a Dream, it is just the upper part of the body which is revealed, somewhat like the Hasselhorst. Is this a classical illusion, in that it allows a certain amount of nakedness while avoiding charges of indecency, and hence appears to evoke a timeless female image? In the anatomist, on this side, the body is completely covered with thin veiling, so that she is clothed, but in a highly suggestive manner. Is Brodnax pondering on mortality, in which case the image is somewhat banal, or is he being more reflective about the nature of dissection itself? Now, we might note here that the pictures are, in fact, interestingly complex. For instance, he includes a knife. There are several that you can see, the one just here. I don't know if you can see it. Sort of, there's a tiny scalpel here. I'm too far away to see on the other one, but I think that there's a knife there as well. So in that sense, I mean, that's a rather classically what one might expect, but you might notice also that he, on this one, has, I think it's on this one, can you see, has the skull actually smoking a pipe. Right. And so clearly he's also being quite playful about the whole thing. Now, I'm sure I don't need to apologize to this audience for showing you pictures by someone who hardly qualifies for the tag of great artist. But I think his interest lies in his rather unself-conscious use of imagery, which in a sense unashamedly reveals the connections between medical knowledge and sexual fantasy. Unfortunately, we know very little about Brodnax himself, and there is no discoverable literature on him, other than a small memorial pamphlet published by the medical school in Virginia where he taught shortly after his death in 1926. And I want to return to this in a moment. But now I want to make two points. First, neither he nor his colleagues seem to refer to the pictures I've just shown you or acknowledge their sexual implications, which can hardly have been lost on them. Second, when Brodnax painted such pictures, he was treading a very difficult path between a, quote, realism, which might be seen as offensive, since painting naked women in the anatomy theatre is a subject which easily breaches taboos, and a generalized depiction which would not offend because it purports to deal with long-established themes in art like mortality, vanitas, and so on. Now, I don't think that in the end Brodnax has a problem here because the women are dead and generalized, so that despite the specificity of the self-portraits, the corpses simply stand for beautiful young dead woman. That is, they're not personal in any way. That opinion was roused in cases where the individuality of the woman was at issue is clear from the controversy surrounding Thomas Eakin's picture, and can we have the one on the other side, please, called William Rush Carving the Schuylkill River, painted in 1876-7. The controversy seems to have been about the naturalistic treatment of individual nudity. Eakin's painting, this is the original one, and this is a later version of the same theme. Eakin's painting shows Rush carving from life, using a model who had been named as a local teacher for wayward girls. I can't help feeling there's somehow something a bit appropriate in that. To defend himself against criticism, this painting was shown at the Centennial Exhibition of 1876, at which another painting by Eakins that I'm going to show you was also shown amid great scandal. To defend himself against criticism, Eakins claimed that Rush had also used as his model a named person, the daughter of a colleague and a friend. So that what Eakins did was to make explicit an association between the personified river and real women. By forcing such a connection on the viewer's attention and by using a style not in the tradition of idealized nudes, and by insisting on drawing from life using totally nude models in mixed classes, Eakin scandalized his contemporaries, resigning from his position at the Philadelphia Academy for Fine Arts in 1886. And I think it's significant that Eakins also painted a number of medical subjects, of which that, of course, can we have the one on the other side, is the most famous. This is the Gross Clinic, the one that he submitted for exhibition in 1876, and it was refused exhibition. It had to go in the tent with the display on military medicine. And this is his later picture of the Agnew Clinic. And at the same time as he was painting this kind of thing, he was using photography of himself and his friends naked in order to get life studies for his own painting. So here is someone who's actually multiply breaching taboos about the body, even where the body in these cases is male. I mean, you may not know this, but this is actually a man who's being operated on. And he's not even revealed in any way that could be in the least bit sort of sexually troubling, I think you'll agree. Now let's return with all of this in mind to the memorial pamphlet to Wilkes Brodnax that I referred to a moment ago. It contains a short appreciation of Brodnax's artistic work by someone called F. William Sievers, who was a sculptor. It contains much guarded praise for Brodnax, while placing him firmly as an amateur. Now, he had actually attended an art school in New York before studying medicine. He briefly mentions Only a Dream, the picture that I just showed you, and is critical of the use of the double self-portrait. He does, however, reserve special praise for a set of pictures Brodnax did of a helper at the medical school. Can we have the one on the other side, please? And I'm going to quote from the memorial. It makes not very pleasant reading, but it's necessary to my argument. And this is what he says, this sculptor says about Brodnax's pictures, quote, "I will make special mention of his wash drawings entitled Peyton." Now, Peyton is that one. This is called Old Chris. "It represents a seated full-length figure of the colored janitor at the Medical College of Virginia. There he sits, comfortable and unmindful of what might seem ghastly surroundings, scraping the boiled flesh from human bones. One wonders whether the several cats feed on the cooked human flesh. The mood and lack of emotion in the darky are perfect. The spirit of the model is correctly portrayed. The darky is alive." Now, two things are striking about these pictures, and they're both mentioned in the quotation I just read. First, obviously, is the question of race, and the second is that of cannibalism. By their very power, the pictures of Peyton make explicit things which are implicit, I think, in the pictures of women. The suggestion of cannibalism, the blurring the boundaries between bodies as objects of knowledge and bodies as food, heightens our sense that anatomy is a transgression. That this could be a sexual transgression is hinted at with the female corpses. It could be a more general violation of the kind I take it Hogarth is referring to. Could we have one on the other side? In his stages of cruelty, which we see very clearly responded to in popular resistance to anatomy and the use of criminals' bodies. But it could also be the transgression of cannibalism. And once you begin to think about pulling the body apart in order to build up skeletons for study, I think you cut very close to the transgression of Frankenstein. Now, the racial aspect of the pictures relates to what can be described as otherness. Women are other to men, as blacks are to white, as animals are to human beings. And you may notice, if we can just go back, could you go back to the... you may notice, interesting, the presence of animals in these pictures, as death is also other to life. All of these are evoked by Brodnack's, and I'd simply remind you here of what I said a few moments ago about Michelet. This sense of otherness is very complicated, obviously, but certain consequences, I think, do flow from it quite naturally. The treatment of the other as more like an object, something to be managed and possessed, and here I just remind you about Beryl Cook's Woman and Car, and at the same time, the other becomes an entity whose very separateness invites inquiring knowledge. And I think it's no coincidence that at the period that Brodnack's was working, we find a very striking coming into prominence of American anthropology at this time, which of course was based on some very, very similar visual strategies. And it's interesting that Franz Boas, the anthropologist,